make a miraculous shot? Yes. Has he ever done it before? You bet he has. Will he ever do it again? Time and time again.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, our turn. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And that, of course, the voice of Chick Hearn, who passed on last week. But I'm still here. Missed you last weekend. I was up in the garlic capital of the world at Gilroy, working with the folks there. But I'm back live and lively here on Stand to Reason, the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the public forum of talk radio. And just for the record, 1-800-227-5278. That's my number up and down the West Coast and coast to coast. But our first hour here, or at least a good portion of it, we're going to be talking about something that's kind of broadly in the news. And in fact, Time Magazine has a piece that's just from a few weeks ago, and you might have seen this. Sometimes, you know, I keep my eye open for these. The latest opinion in the area of human evolution. And in this one, we have a picture of what appears to be some chimps in the tree looking over a broad savanna. And the title here is Father of Us All, big question mark, brand new discovery in Chad, of all places, an entirely different location from where most of the ancient hominid fossils have been discovered. And this one's unique because it's rather modern looking for its age. And what is that age? Well, something like 7 million years old, which is about as much younger than the famous Lucy fossil as Lucy is from you and I. It's twice as old as Lucy. And that's old, yet seems to show some more modern characteristics. Anyway, it just raises the question again about human evolution. And what the evidence for it happens to be. I'm not an expert in this area, but I know some. And so we've asked one to be with us here this first hour to talk about this issue. He's the author of Icons of Evolution. Why much of what we teach about evolution is wrong. We've had Jonathan Wells on before. He's with the Discovery Institute and also holds dual PhDs, one from University of California at Berkeley in molecular and cell biology, another one at Yale University in religious studies. He's done postdoctoral research at UC Berkeley, and I think he's very qualified to help us to understand this latest news about a new discovery of an alleged precursor to modern man in the evolutionary tree. Dr. Wells, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
It hasn't been that long since we've had you on. I think in the fall we had you and, J. Wesley Richards. We spent some time together talking about your book, Icons, huh?
Yes. Uh-huh.
You have a chapter in Icons devoted to human evolution. And I don't know that when we were together last time, Jonathan, that we talked much about that chapter. But here's a great opportunity to kind of revisit some of that information. So before we get into this latest development, I thought maybe we'd take a moment and lay a little bit of a foundation from your chapter, From Ape to Human, The Ultimate Icon. Could you give us a sketch of the Darwinian view of human evolution and maybe some of the evidence for it? And then we can talk a little bit about maybe what's wrong, in your view, with some of the evidence for human evolution.
Sure. Well, Darwin, of course, himself sketched out the theory in his book, The Descent of Man.
Mm-hmm.
Which he wrote just after The Origin of Species. And according to Darwin's theory, ape-like creatures that lived millions of years ago varied in their abilities and their appearance, and certain of those varieties were more beneficial in certain environments than others,
mm-hmm.
and were preserved by natural selection, and gradually led to a transformation of that ape-like creature into the modern human species.
Mm-hmm.
That's Darwin's theory in a nutshell.
So in other words, he just took the basic ideas that he developed in Origin of Species and simply applied them to human evolution.
That's correct. In fact, at the time, he had absolutely no evidence for human evolution per se.
Mm-hmm. He just figured if it happened to everything else in this fashion, then it must have happened to human beings in that fashion as well.
Yes, exactly. And mm-hmm. it's a reasonable extrapolation Of course, I have a problem with his first claim.
Right.
It explains anything at all in the history of life.
Given the first claim is reasonable and true and well-substantiated, and human beings are part of the natural system that developed in this way, we'd expect humans to have developed in that way. But
yes.
It's the primary evidence that's the problem in this case, right?
Yes, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it even gets worse with humans.
Mm-hmm.
If the first part of the story is true, the extrapolation is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Although far from proven, because we actually have very little evidence that directly bears on human evolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's why a find such as the one you described in your introductory remarks occasions such excitement,
mm-hmm.
because there's so little evidence to begin with.
Well, this is, okay, we'll be getting specifically to that, to this recent find in a moment, because it strikes me, and I'd be interested in your response when we get there, is that this creates more problems than it solves, as far as I understand it, which is part of the picture of the, as far as, from where I sit when I look at these, the picture of the human evolutionary, program at all, the whole characterization of it. It just seems to go from one scenario to another, and one's dismantled, the other one's created almost out of whole cloth. But in any event, what is, since Darwin, okay, there has been a development of this concept of human evolution, and most of us growing up in the last 50 years have been treated to varying graphic illustrations of this, especially in National Geographic and some of the other news weeklies. And so we're familiar with this progression from small little hairy creature to something that looks more like a modern man, and then into the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons, and finally to the modern man. We've seen this this depiction, these pictures, in every single one of the articles that deals with it. What are we to make of those characterizations?
Well, I think the fundamental thing to realize is that that all of them are highly imaginative. The fact is, we don't know what these creatures looked like.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if they were hairy. We don't know what color their skin was. In many cases, we don't really know what their bodies looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have, basically, is Darwin's story and these little pieces of fossil that are found along the way that are plugged into that story to sort of put window dressing on the story.
Mm-hmm.
At root, the story is highly subjective.
Mm-hmm. You make a comment here in Icons on page 216. This is the chapter that deals with human evolution. And incidentally, this is I've referred to this book many times in the past. In fact, last weekend when I was teaching and last week on issues that brushed on this, I highly recommended your book as basically if students have one book to read, I think Icons is the best book that will give them, in a sense, ammunition readily available to deal with the evidence is offered for evolution and show the problems, as you have with many of these, the peppered moth and Haeckel's illustrations of the embryos and homology and Archaeopteryx and transitional forms and all of that. But in this one chapter here, so there's a pitch for the book, but in this one chapter on From Ape to Human, the Ultimate Icon, you write, from the very beginning, the ape to human icon was simply a restatement of materialistic philosophy. Its form preceded any fossil evidence of ancestor-descent relationships, and it may do with whatever evidence happened to be at hand, in this case, similarities to living apes. Fossils discovered later were just plugged in to this pre-existing framework. Could you talk about that quote a little bit and help us to understand that?
Well, I'm actually basing that on statements made by people who are experts in the field of human evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these people believe in Darwin's theory. They
mm-hmm.
believe it's true and that we really did evolve from ape-like creatures. But they themselves acknowledge that what they do when they create these stories is exactly as I described. They
mm-hmm.
plug the meager fossil evidence into a pre-existing story, and the story actually follows the presuppositions of whoever's telling it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you happen to believe that we evolved because we descended from the trees, or because we grew opposable thumbs, or we learned to speak, or something
to walk upright.
Walk upright, that's mm-hmm. a favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
Then the story follows that storyline, and
mm-hmm.
the fossils are simply plugged into it.
So what they do is suggest a storyline based on another storyline. That would be the storyline of of the general theory of evolution writ large. They apply that general storyline to what it must have been like if, in fact, we did evolve as human beings, and they try to plug the fossils into that. Now, it seems to me that, of necessity, that's kind of the way science has to work to some degree, isn't it? I mean, they have to come up with some characterization about how it might have happened and then begin to plug the evidence into it, right?
Yes. By itself, I wouldn't say that it's a fatal objection to Darwinism. As you hinted a few minutes ago, my objection is that the evidence on which the general theory is based turns out to be faulty, seriously mm-hmm. faulty.
And that's the subject primarily of your book, Icons of Evolution.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem is, if you look at this new fossil find, it actually turns out to upset many of the stories that had previously been told.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of the media hype that we're getting that this, as you read in Time, the father of us all, question
mm-hmm.
mark.
Mm-hmm. And they always start out that way. Missing link, question mark. And it's always the question mark that is so significant, it seems to me, when you read the details.
Yes, because it's very much a question mark.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And actually, this new fossil makes things vastly more complicated than anybody previously thought.
Now, it seems to me, and this kind of brings me to my next point that I want to explore a little bit with you, Dr. Wells, and that is it seems that here's my main concern with hominid fossils and the speculative evolutionary lineages that they have spawned for the last 50 years, okay? It seems to me that every new piece of evidence throws the old scenario, whatever scenario it happened to be at the time, and a scenario boldly endorsed up until that moment, it throws that scenario into disarray. And then a new scenario of evolutionary descent is kind of restructured or sketched out based on this new evidence. And I know to some degree you can't avoid this because science has got to kind of move along speculatively in a sense, but it seems to me that the continual problems that they're having sketching this out in a reasonable way begins to suggest that maybe somebody's barking up the wrong tree here. I mean, it becomes a self-serving exercise here and almost ad hoc in the way they keep piecing things together.
Well, exactly. The theory is so plastic that it basically can be molded to conform to whatever evidence happens to pop up.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your book about those different views that people have about how things might have taken place and in terms of the evolution of man. And then you say here, let's see if I can find the quote on page 225, the fossils have been placed into pre-existing narrative structures. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think I'm looking for that quote myself. I think that may have actually come from an expert in the field,
mm-hmm.
Or something like it.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that is a quote from someone who actually works on hominid fossils.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the narrative structure is what survives and persists, and the fossils sort of come and go. Now, one interesting thing about this new fossil, if I can mention that for a minute,
okay,
is that in many ways it looks a lot more like a chimp or a gorilla than it does like a human.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it so happens,
in terms of bone structure, what you're referring to.
Facial structure.
Facial.
We don't have the body.
Because we just have the skull, a fairly
skull.
Significant portion?
Well, enough to make some good guesses.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing we can tell from it is that it has a gorilla-like brow.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the interesting thing here is that we, officially, there are no fossils of chimpanzees. Chimpanzee has no fossil record.
Huh.
Every time a fossil like this is found, it's automatically called the father of us all.
I see. Uh-huh.
And so where are the fossil chimpanzees? They've all been shoehorned into this narrative structure of mm-hmm. human evolution.
Or certainly possibly. In fact, as I'm looking at the latest characterization, you know, the flow through time with all the the images of the hominid creatures here, kind of on the timeline, Here we have the gorillas and chimpanzees, a timeline going back with no fossils on, and it fades into the distant past even prior to this 7-million-year-old example that they just discovered. And everything else is patched in to the flow of human evolution, as suggested. It's somewhere in that mix, ending up maybe with Homo erectus or with Neanderthal, which these are allegedly now dead ends on the evolutionary chain to modern humans. But you're right, they totally disregard. Now, why is that? Isn't it possible in their minds that these could be on the evolutionary chain to chimpanzees, or is it just that's not a very sexy way of interpreting the evidence and doesn't get them headlines?
Well, I'm not an expert on these fossils, I have to admit, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to cast too many aspersions, but I do find it very strange that these fossils are invariably, without exception, plugged into the human line, no matter almost what they look like. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks for a strong bias here to find evidence for human evolution. Who cares about chimpanzee evolution?
Right. Yeah, that's right. So this is, like I said, a bit sexier. There's another quote I want to go to. It's page 218 of your book here in the same chapter on From Ape to Human, the Ultimate Icon. And you actually do point out here that the from ape to human is actually, strictly speaking, a mischaracterization because allegedly on the evolutionary framework, humans and apes, modern humans and modern apes, kind of had parallel evolutions. One didn't come from the other. But there was a common ancestor in the distant past now pushed to prior to 7 million years ago, right?
Yes, and Darwin himself pointed that out. Strictly speaking, we are not descended from gorillas or chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that we're all descended from some common ancestor,
mm-hmm.
which has never been found.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the quote here. You write, but even genuine fossils that bear on human origins have typically been so controversial that in 1970, British anthropologist John Napier called them bones of contention. And each new discovery seems to add to the problem rather than alleviate it. And then you mentioned that Niles Eldridge and company says that notes the myth that the evolutionary histories of living things are essentially a matter of discovery. If this were really true, they wrote, quote, one could confidently expect that as more hominid fossils were found, the story of human evolution would become clearer, whereas, if anything, the opposite has occurred. So it seems like as time is going on, the more evidence that we get, the more confusion that it throws into the whole picture here about what actually happened.
Well, I think this recent discovery is the best example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a controversy over, first of all, whether it's part of the human line or part of the chimpanzee or gorilla line.
Mm-hmm. Which controversy doesn't seem to be mentioned specifically in the articles that I've read because they want to focus on the human descendancy. But you're saying that's a real possibility if you accept their evolutionary assessment, generally speaking, right?
Yes, but if you read the professional literature, there really is a controversy over whether this is even in the human line.
Hmm.
And if it is in the human line, it vastly complicates things because in some ways it looks more modern than Lucy,
mm-hmm.
Who is only half as old.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would you have this more modern-looking fossil 7 million years ago and then something more primitive 3.5 million years
right.
ago?
Right.
Mm-hmm. All of a sudden the whole record becomes very much more confused.
It doesn't fill the picture. Well, when we come back, we'll go into more detail on this latest find and talk about it. My guest, Dr. Jonathan Wells, he's the author of Icons of Evolution, Science or Myth, and we're talking about the latest find in Chad, kind of out of the normal area for finding these kinds of things, another issue. To be discussed here that has to do with human evolution. What does this new development tell us or not tell us and about the validity of evolution? We'll talk more about that when we return on Stand to Reason.
Hi, friends. This is Scott Klusendorf, and every year in the United States, there are over 1.4 million abortions performed. If you're ready to defend the unborn, then I want to enroll you in a class taught by Greg Kokel and me. Stand to Reason's interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will give you the tools you need to 1) restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, Two, it will help you simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question. Thirdly, it's going to give you the scientific evidence you need to make a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument. And finally, you're going to be able to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. If you're ready to take a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 800-2 and the word reason. That's 800-2 and the word reason, or visit us online at str.org.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel. Friends, you can help keep Stand to Reason broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift of any size helps us to continue training you and other Christians to be effective ambassadors for Christ in three vital areas. First, knowledge, helping you deliver a message that's accurately informed, made relevant to the culture of the 21st century. Second, wisdom, helping you develop a method that's skillful, tactical, and fair. And third, character, helping you cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about in the church and in the world, please consider supporting STR Radio today. We rely solely on the gifts of friends like you to stay on the air. So please call us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. And thank you for sending your gift today.
It takes a lot of faith to say we're accidents of nature.
Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. And before we get back to our guest, Jonathan Wells, author of Icons of Evolution, just a quick note to those who are listening on oneplace.com, and there are a lot of you, I've been looking at the stats, really glad to have you on board. I want to encourage you, if you found us through OnePlace, to come and visit our website, but especially to avail yourself of our free training materials that we can send you on a monthly basis. So if you're listening to our show at oneplace.com, here's how you do that. Just scroll down the STR page where you found our show until you see free offer solid ground, and then click the button that says order, and then just follow the prompts. And if you do that, it takes a few minutes to give us your name and address, tell us where you live, and we'll send you our bi-monthly newsletter, Solid Ground, and then an alternating month you get a letter from me, both that are geared for giving you practical answers to tough questions, giving you thoughtful reflections on current issues, giving you recommendations on thought-provoking resources to help you to be a better ambassador for Christ. So when you're done signing up, by the way, there for the Solid Ground, cruise through the website, and I think you'll really be surprised at the resources you'll find there. So special instructions for our OnePlace.com listeners. Glad to have you on board. And if you're listening, by the way, anywhere in the United States, remember you can always call when we're doing open calls, which is normally between 3 and 5 Sunday afternoons here at Los Angeles time. Just dial our 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason number, and you can get me. Right now, we don't have open lines because we're talking with my guest, Dr. Jonathan Wells. His book, Icons of Evolution, Science or Myth, why much of what we teach about evolution is wrong is really ought to be a standard in your library if you don't have it. It's I was just speaking to a bunch of students over in Hume Lake, in fact, the last 2 weeks, and I mentioned to them, if you want one book that will help you to deal with this issue, Icons of Evolution is the book. That author, Jonathan Wells, with me. We're talking about the latest find in Africa that is touted as new evidence about human evolution. And part of the problem we're facing, Dr. Wells, is just the problem with how exact the science of hominid paleontology actually is. You mentioned in your book that it's part of the problem of human origins is the difficulty or even impossibility of determining ancestor-descent relationships from the fossil record. Why is that?
Well, when you think about it, if you wanted to trace your own genealogy 10 generations back mm-hmm. with written records, it would not be a simple matter. That's why some people make their living off helping others to do this. With the fossil record, we're talking about thousands or even millions of generations, and we're talking about different species. How do you show that one species evolved from another when you're missing a million generations?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. And many paleontologists recognize this. They know that they're basically assuming common ancestry and then trying to piece the record together from these fossils.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we accept the common ancestry notion, the idea that we really did evolve from ape-like creatures,
mm-hmm.
then this enterprise makes sense. But what if we have some fundamental skepticism about the very assumption, which
right.
I happen to have?
Mm-hmm.
Then the whole thing becomes very much dicier.
Well, actually, it's even worse than that, because these guys accept the whole picture, the general theory of evolution, and so something like this will make sense, in a sense, in the abstract, but given the evidence that's before them, they're still running into all kinds of problems, even when they assume the Darwinian story, if I can put it that way. And specifically here with this new find, we have that very problem. Now, tell us about where this specimen was found. And I think they gave me two, as I'm reading, I see two names for it. Sahelanthropus chadensis or Tumi. Am I close with the pronunciations there? Or?
Yes, it's Tumi.
Tumi, okay.
Very close. It was found in Chad, which is not where most human-like fossils have been found. Most
mm-hmm.
have been found in the Rift Valley of East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting find. There's no question about it. It adds significantly to our knowledge of the fossil record. The question is, what does it tell us?
Mm-hmm.
I think you were quite correct to point out that there's two problems here. One is, do we accept the basic framework? And even if we do accept the basic framework, what do these very meager fossil finds, very few and far between, what do they tell us about that record?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, this new Tumi fossil, according to the best estimates, it turns the human evolution story from a rather simple one into a very complicated bush with
mm-hmm.
lots of dead ends.
Mm-hmm.
So even if we accept the basic story, this new fossil does not help it much.
So the old way of looking at it was kind of the tree that most of us envision from the pictures that we saw in the book, and the tree would be, in the large sense, the grand sense, the tree of life, all living things. But even when you get to the individual sections, each is a branching out segment where you have these kind of clean characterizations or these clean breaks between different things, or at least that's the point of view. Now that's being abandoned in some measure, at least in what you're saying is in human paleontology, or hominid, I should say, paleontology. But as I understand it, Stephen Jay Gould has suggested something like this for the whole picture and not just for human paleontology. Can you talk a little bit more about what that bush is by comparison to the way they used to think of it?
Well, if you buy the theory, you have to believe in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
There just has to be a tree. There has to be, you know,
common ancestry.
Yes, we come from a common ancestor that looked vaguely like us but was more ape-like, and that creature in turn came from a common ancestor. And if we could trace the record back, we would find a branch point where chimpanzees and gorillas and we all share a common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
So that tree has to be there if the theory is true. The problem with these fossil finds is that each one seems to be somewhere off that branch. And so, you know, even though the branch or this branch that we're the end of
mm-hmm.
should be the most prominent feature of the record, it's forever eluding our grasp in the fossil record because all these fossils turn out to be, you know, dead ends off to the side.
So we keep trying to find the creatures that are kind of on the superhighway to eventually becoming human, and we keep finding all these guys that are out in the bushes somewhere, out in the field, and they're just off the main track. And so
that's a good way to put it.
And the only isn't it a way? It's a kind of a way of acknowledging that we just simply don't have the evidence yet of any precursor to human beings that seem to be very clear. Because all the rest of them, I remember when way back when Neanderthal was the big contender, at least in the most recent history, and now he's off to the side, and And, you know, Lucy, you know, I don't know where she's at anymore. She's pretty old, 3.5 million years. But then you have all those in between the leaky finds, you know, in the rift, in the Great Rift Valley there you talked about in Africa. But all of these are kind of out of contention now. And so it doesn't seem like anybody's on the highway anymore.
Well, there certainly are people who still think Lucy is in the direct line.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a significant number of experts who think she's not. And as you say, the basic problem is that where we would expect to find the clearest record, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do find always seems to be somewhere off in the bushes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess it's just the nature of the beast, so to speak, that it's just impossible to find or to determine or to establish a genuine phylogenetic relationship between these specimens, just like you said with the, you know, for trying to figure out your ancestry in the last 10 years. I mean, when you got a million years, all you can do is speculate. It seems to me that this thing is necessarily driven by a philosophy about how it happened. And there's nothing that you could draw from the evidence itself that can tell you about what actually did take place.
Well, I think that's correct. I would add that if the basic theory were better supported, I would find the extrapolations more plausible.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that we really have no idea how a chimpanzee-like creature could possibly evolve into a human being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have ideas in the sense that we have speculation.
In the abstract, almost.
In the abstract.
Right.
As soon as you get down to the evidence, it mm-hmm. all evaporates.
Well, there's two problems, as far as I can tell, Dr. Wells. One of them is the evidence proper. In other words, what evidence do we have that that this history actually took place? And, of course, that's the whole question of the fossil evidence. But then you have the other problems, and maybe this is more to your area of specialization in molecular and cell biology. You've got all of the cellular, molecular, DNA-level kinds of changes that need to be made before the body itself begins to change in the kinds of ways that are suggested from Lucy up till modern humans or whoever the ancient missing link happens to be. So that's a second problem.
Yes, and I would say it's even more fundamental. My main field is embryology.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you, you can take an embryo of one species and do whatever you want to it. I worked on frogs myself.
Mm-hmm.
You can fiddle with the DNA. You can, cut it apart and put it back together again, anything you want. And there's only three possible outcomes. One is you'll kill it,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't do anybody any good.
Right. Doesn't get its genes in the next generation for evolution, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Another possibility is that it will somehow overcome all the damage you've done and become a healthy frog or whatever it was supposed to be in the first place.
Go back to the original type, in a sense.
That's right.
Survive all your machinations, okay.
That's right, and come out relatively healthy. And the only other possibility is that it will become a frog of the original species, but it will be damaged.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be significantly deformed, essentially crippled.
Mm-hmm.
There are no other options. I mean, every attempt that has been made to produce in the laboratory the sort of changes that Darwin's theory requires
mm-hmm.
has failed.
Mm-hmm. So this whole human evolution thing is compromised on two fronts. One, on the manufacture side, as it were. How could such changes take place through the cells, and how could evolution get its biological momentum? And secondly, whether, as a matter of fact, the historical evidence in the fossil record does demonstrate such a thing actually happened. Both are serious problems for this view when it comes to human evolution. That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Hmm. Well, what about question about the dating method? They say this critter they got now is 7 million years. Lucy's 3.5. Are you comfortable with the dating method? How reliable is that in your view?
Well, the reason they date this new fossil at 7 million, they haven't dated it directly, but it was found with other fossils that had been dated previously at that date.
I see.
Elsewhere.
Uh-huh. So it's index fossil dating kind of thing.
Yes, it's indirect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as the dating goes, when I read the Bible, I don't read it in such a way that it requires me to assume a young Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Many of my friends and colleagues do read it that way, but I don't.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the actual dates are entirely a matter of evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, whatever the evidence seems to show, I'm willing to accept. I have no problem with whatever dates fit the evidence.
Right.
And 10 years ago, I would have said, well, the evidence overwhelmingly shows that these dates are approximately accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 10 years, I have experienced so much misrepresentation of the evidence coming from the Darwinian camp
mm-hmm.
that now I like to call myself an agnostic when it comes to the dates.
Mm-hmm.
Since I have not looked at the evidence myself, I reserve judgment. I have no in principle objection to them.
Right.
But I must admit I have become increasingly skeptical of their accuracy.
So, you're jaundiced, you had to take a jaundiced view, rather, towards the evidence because you've seen twisting in other areas that makes you wonder about whether the work is sound in this area. Is that
exactly
is that the right read on you?
Exactly. I see the evidence so consistently being distorted because mm-hmm. of Darwinian preconceptions that I'm suspicious of it across the board at this point.
Dr. Wells, let me just give you one last question here before we go. I'm just curious, how do you personally assess the evidence? I mean, if you were to reconstruct what actually took place in hominid history, I mean, do you have any speculations? I mean, are these just things that grew and died out? Is there any descent with modification going on here at all? What would you make of the evidence?
Well, I have no problem with the idea that there were creatures before us that, mm-hmm. Were somehow intermediate between us and the apes.
When you say intermediate, you don't mean phylogenetically intermediate, that is, that they were actually in our ancestry, but that their bodies looked intermediate. They were kind of, is that what...
Yes.
Is that what you mean? Okay.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In order for me to buy the idea of descent with modification, that is, that we are actually descendants of these creatures, I would have to see some evidence, the sort of evidence I was referring to earlier, where, creatures could be transformed into other species.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen that evidence. I've seen quite the opposite.
You mean you'd need to see the evidence on a molecular level that the kind of information needed for these changes in the body could actually happen on the molecular level where it's needed?
Well, that would be one level.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the organism as a whole is actually another level, but I would have to see some evidence on at least some of those levels if
mm-hmm.
I've not seen it.
Well, you're making
I don't buy the idea that we descended from other creatures that were different species.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, I don't have any problem with the idea that such creatures preceded us.
Mm-hmm.
I would use the analogy, as in fact Darwinists have used it, of a series of automobiles. Corvette automobiles is a favorite analogy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see a model one year and another model the following year and so on up to the present. And they follow a certain pattern. You know, they're not just randomly created.
Mm-hmm.
But they are created. They're created by design.
And you, even though you do see some similarities there, I guess there's a way of saying that the homology argument, that is the similarities, could be either explained by descent with modification in the Darwinian sense or descent with modification in the creationist sense or the intelligent design sense, right?
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't know that I would call it descent.
No, right.
So we could have a series of fossils. Indeed, I have no problem with that, but it seems to me that it's much more plausible to say that they are explained as designed products
mm-hmm.
of an intelligent agent rather than accidental byproducts of a natural process.
Dr. Wells, is there a publicly accessible website with the Discovery Institute, which you are involved in, that people can go to get more information about what they're doing and what you're doing as well?
Absolutely. You want me to mention it?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's www.discovery.org, O-R-G.
Well, that's pretty easy.
It is. Just don't go to discovery.com. That's a different enterprise.
Okay, discovery.org. And then you have part of the Discovery Institute is dedicated to this whole question of intelligent design, and you've been a part of that along with quite a few others that we've had here on the show. Doctor, thank you so much for spending a little time with us here on the Sunday afternoon and for kind of bringing us up to date on this new information.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
We'll look forward to talking to you next time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jonathan Wells, the author of Icons of Evolution. That's the book published by Regnery. And How much of what we teach about evolution is wrong? In fact, we have this at Stand to Reason. You're welcome to call us for that. Oh, lines are open now, 1-800-227-5278. Or in the Orange County area code 714, dial 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, friends. Greg Kokel here. Open lines for you at Stand to Reason. And 1-800-227-5278 is the number. And if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Thanks to Scott Klusendorf last week, by the way, for filling in for me when I was out of town. And I know you always like having Scott on. He's, frankly, I think he's the best sit-in host, so to speak, fill-in host that I have. It's good to have him on the job here. Just a thought as you're getting in the queue here, talking to the enforcer. A couple of months ago, it seems now, actually I wrote this, so maybe it's just been recently, you've gotten the Solid Ground that deals with the issue of homosexuality and the question of whether homosexuality is natural or not, and if it is natural, then how can we object to it morally? You know, it's just an additional thought on that. And incidentally, if you don't get Solid Ground, go to our website and sign up for it, str.org. It's very easy. Sign up for it there. Call our office during the week, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, and you can talk to somebody during the week, and deal with we'll sign you up there on the phone. That's easy. But another thing that a thought that I've been having about this, I mentioned this generally, the topic. I think the title just doing what comes naturally, I guess was the title or something along that line. And my argument was, it's not clear that this is natural. Homosexuals are that way because of some natural indicator in their body, some genetic predisposition. And secondly, that it wouldn't really matter. But because you can't get an ought from an is. Just because somebody is that way doesn't mean they ought to be that way. And so I offer that argumentation and mention that the difference between just doing what comes naturally and principled self-restraint is called civilization. that's the whole point of morals, isn't it? To stop doing what comes naturally, because what comes naturally may not always be right. But I just had another thought about that, another angle. And because it is common of late to justify one's sexual orientation by this appeal to nature, the claim "I was born this way" is all that's needed to stem moral criticism of homosexuality. And my response is, why settle for this approach? That is, why think that the state of nature is an appropriate guide to morality? Now, my comment a few moments ago suggested this thought, but here's another angle to it. Thomas Hobbes, he's a 17th century philosopher, noted famously that life in an unregulated state of nature is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And it was precisely this fact, according to Hobbes now, that caused humans to enter into social contracts, gladly accepting the moral constraints of civilization to its alternative, the law of nature. Simply put, people didn't like the law of nature. It was brutal. And this gives rise to morality, according to Hobbes, that morality is an extension of that kind of social contract, a way of protecting ourselves from the brutality of living in a world where people simply did what came naturally. Now, if morality is a way to protect us, even on this view, in a world where people simply did what came naturally, how can doing something because it comes naturally be a moral justification? I mean, since living according to nature would easily justify all kinds of barbarism, right? How does it make sense to invoke the natural state of things to justify anything? Behavior that's natural is the very thing that morality is meant to protect us from. And back to Hobbes again, morality that counters one's natural inclinations rather than commends them is our only refuge from a life that is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. All right, to your phone calls. Mike, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called. Hi.
Oh, boy, put me right on here.
Sure did.
Well, yeah, you know, just your last comment there, you switched subjects. You know, it depends if the action is harmful or not harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And killing and rape are harmful, whereas homosexuality, not from your point of view, but from others, is not harmful. So you have to differentiate among what's natural, whether it's good, neutral, bad. But I wanted to...
Can I jump in just for a moment, Mike? I think you are... This is a good observation, that just saying a thing is natural doesn't resolve the issue. What you have to do is you have to import some kind of a moral rule to judge the moral behavior. And I agree with you entirely there.
You don't mean a moral rule. You mean a Judeo-Christian biblical
rule. No, I mean a moral rule. If you're going to come to a moral conclusion, you have to use a moral standard.
Consensual and not being hurt by it.
Well, that's a moral rule. You just offered one.
Oh, it's not your business to implement some fascist... spiritual, fascist, right or wrong. That's the difference.
Okay, well, see, what you've done is you've just introduced a moral rule, and the moral rule is as long as it doesn't hurt someone and it is consensual. So you have introduced a moral rule which you think homosexuality fulfills.
Right.
The irony is that when I introduce my moral rule and say that it's against nature or it's not the way God intended, you call my moral rule fascist, but you're very comfortable with imposing your moral rule as long as it doesn't hurt anybody or it's consensual.
But you have to appeal to nature to see what's universal. And Judeo-Christianity, I'll link them here because it comes out of the Jewish Bible, is totally, irrational and non-universal. It has a special people, a one son of a god. I mean, you worship a Jewish man as God, which is, how irrational can you get?
Okay, well, whether Jesus is God is a separate issue to what we're discussing here. We start out talking about how do you ground morality.
Right. Well,
and this
is an old discussion.
Wait a minute, Mike. Wait, Mike. Hold on just a second. I just want to go back over what we talked about just a moment ago. You said you started out, how do you ground, with talking about morality, and you challenged my grounding as if you don't need a moral rule, and then you cite moral rules.
No, I never said that.
Okay.
I never said you don't need a moral rule. I said you have to determine what's moral, what's natural.
Right, okay.
And just because something is natural, it doesn't mean it's necessarily good
I agree.
Or bad.
We're agreed there.
Homosexuality is universal.
Pardon me?
Well, let me get to...
Wait, did you say... What was the last thing you said? That homosexuality is universal?
Yeah, homosexuality.
What does that mean, that it's universal?
What?
I'm not sure what you mean, it's universal.
I mean, every single culture there have been homosexuals.
Well, okay, what is that? What follows from the fact that there are homosexuals in every single culture? What follows from that for our discussion?
That it's part of the human race. It's part of the human condition.
Well, yeah, but all evil things are part of a human condition.
Yeah,
because
you're saying that it's evil. There's nobody who's getting hurt by it.
No, wait. No, let's just take this step by step. You are simply citing a universal condition, and in the citing of the universal condition, you seem to be suggesting that there's something not wrong with it because it's universal. But there are a lot of universal things that are wrong, so we have to use it.
Nobody's hurt by it.
Well, that's another question now. Okay, so what you're saying is that the only things that are wrong is if your actions hurt some other people.
That's a major criterion.
Okay, let's just see. For the sake of discussion, let's just accept that as a criterion. And I accept the notion that in moral thinking, the principle of harm is a part of the program. I don't think it's the whole part. In other words, it's the only question, but it sure is one.
Is anybody hurt?
So would you say if homosexuality creates harm in anybody, then that homosexuality would be wrong. Is that right?
Yes, I would.
Okay, so when homosexuality causes...
One second, I would say if that heterosexuality harms somebody, that's wrong too.
Okay, so when homosexuality causes the spread of disease...
Any kind of sexual act, mm-hmm. any kind of speech, going out, you know, you could go out and get hit by a car. You want to ban cars? I mean, everything can be causing harm. That's mm-hmm. the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the question is whether the thing itself is an innate harm. When homosexuality, for example, spreads disease by the very nature of the conduct, right?
Look, if you have a problem with...
I'm using your criterion here. If it causes harm...
We're just going to go on.
Mike, I'm just applying your criterion. That's all I'm doing.
What about the? I want to get to the eighth thing because we're not going to solve it. You're going to base everything on the Bible.
You have mentioned the Bible quite a number of times. I have not mentioned it once in our conversation. I keep working with your criterion
because it's not banned by the Bible.
We're not talking about the Bible. We're talking about homosexuality. I'm not invoking
it's
the Bible.
The Jewish Bible, as far as I know, that bans homosexuality.
Well, homosexuality has been viewed as immoral by virtually every single society, even though there are occasions of homosexuality in all those societies. So this is, I mean, I don't know what standard you're working with
here
now.
Well, the Greco-Roman world.
Practice homosexuality in certain conditions.
All right, we're not going to get anywhere with this. You have your opinion on sex. If you don't want,
okay.
Hello?
I'm listening, Mike.
Do you believe in sodomizing?
Mike, I'm following your lead. What do you want to get to, Mike? What's your main point here? I'm just following your lead so far. You make comments, I respond to them. So
yeah, the eighth thing is interesting. How do you explain? Now, I'm not a Darwinian. I mean, you didn't ask, but how do you explain the similarity between apes and humans, like dogs and wolves?
Mm-hmm.
How does he explain that? And certainly among certain groups of humans.
Well, if you're asking how do we explain it, we have to explain it according to a certain paradigm. So if I think that the evidence is that their intelligent designer is responsible for things, then those similarities are easy to explain. Just like when you look at spoons and you can line up a bunch of spoons in front of you, different spoons serve a little bit different purposes for the circumstances that you use them in. Let me finish the thought here, Mike. And so therefore they are designed a little differently for those circumstances. I don't understand what's so controversial about that. That fits perfectly.
Your guy said there was no evidence for descent, or did he say relationship?
It's phylogenetic relationship. That's descent with modification, that there's an ancestral line here. There is no evidence for that.
But there are definitely similarities between the ape form, the chimp form.
Sure, but the similarities, this is called homology, what you're referring to now, and the similarities themselves don't imply a phylogenetic relationship. I mean... They don't necessarily, because there are other explanations that account for that. Just like the spoons, you have all these different spoon shapes. My son asked me about this once. I opened the drawer and pulled out all these different spoons.
Okay.
These spoons are created for a purpose, and therefore there's similarities in the design.
Okay, I see that point. I myself come from a more or less UFO / esoteric point on this, and I think that would be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you're referring to. We're actually going to do a whole show on that coming up not too long from now, in a couple of, 2 weeks, is that right? Was that 2 months? That's a week from today? A week from today we'll be doing that show. talking about the UFO connection and see if that solves your problem. It turns out going to UFOs as a source for evolution, life on Earth, it's called directed panspermia. We're going to talk about that in detail as well, but I don't think it's going to get you what you want.
Well, I mean, you know,
when you look at the evidence.
The theory is, even in the Bible, I mean, even in is that the ape stock was used and the was either cloned or genetically modified.
Wait, the ape stock in the Bible was genetically modified?
The theory is.
What are you referring to?
With it is that from the esoteric point of view and the UFO point of view, you're probably not familiar with esotericism, but.
Well, it depends what you mean by it, but go ahead.
The theory is that. The ape stock, and it's not established. I don't know if it's established that it's older than the humans, but let's say it is, assumption.
Well, they don't have any evidence for ape evolution or chimpanzee evolution, apparently. All of this has been shifted over on the human side, but go ahead.
Was used to graft or clone or genetically modify and refine the form for an incarnating human race.
Okay, so you believe in intelligent design then, because that's what that is,
I'm not a Darwinian. But you know, when you look at, I don't know if you want to allow me to say this, when you look at certainly Negroes, you see a tremendous similarity to apes in their face and body language.
Really? Well, I don't know how many Negroes you've seen, but that strikes me as a bit bizarre.
Any, Greg, I'm on another planet. I haven't seen any.
Well, that's why. I mean, it just strikes me as odd because I think that a lot of people will take exception with the facticity of your observation.
So you're also politically correct. It's interesting.
No. I'm just saying, I look at a lot of African Americans, blacks, wherever they came from, they don't look like apes to me. You go in and you see an ape, and you see an ape in the zoo, and he doesn't look like an African American, unless they're darker skinned. But of course, Indians have dark skin too. That is, people from India.
Well, they both have black skin. They both came out of Africa. The face is similar.
Well, you mean that they have nose and eyes and chin and the like?
The pimp walk is with the hand swinging behind the back.
Yeah, so this is characteristic of Africans. I have seen a lot of African Americans, and they don't walk like that at all.
But some do,
and so do some white people.
No, the more primitive of them. What about these dances when they do this dance? You ever watch these black videos on cable?
Yeah, it's not my style, but I think they dance a lot better than gorillas. Mike, it was good talking to you. It was a very interesting conversation. I followed here, and I thank you for your call. I followed here an old dictum that whenever any caller wants to make a fool out of themselves, you get out of the way. Hour number two coming right up, and then I will have some comments for you at the start about what I call the magic prayer and also your calls. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman.
Greg Kokel back with you here. Hour number two on our show. And I'll be taking your calls for most of this hour, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, that's local to me, 754-4150. And we're going to have a quick update here. Last week we had, this is a political issue, but it's a very important one, political slash moral issue. Last week Scott had Randy Thomason on, executive director of Save California Families, and they talked for quite a while about some new legislation that is passing through the State Assembly, and you need to know more details about it, especially something about press conferences coming up this week. And so we've asked Randy to come on board for just a few minutes and let you know what's happening here in Southern California. And Randy, when I read off those phone numbers, those are familiar phone numbers to you, aren't they?
Well, they certainly are. Hi, Greg. Thanks for letting me on today.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. Randy worked with me, or I worked with him is probably a better way of putting it, right here at KBRT, our flagship station in Southern California. When I first started broadcasting now almost 13 years ago, Randy.
It's been a long time.
It has been.
Let me just cut to the chase.
Sure, go ahead.
We are we have a real problem with the foster care system right now in California. There are more foster care children that need homes than there are foster care homes.
Mm-hmm.
Introduce AB 2651. This bill would promote the homosexual, bisexual, and transsexual lifestyle within foster care. Mm-hmm. It would essentially train foster parents to accept and, we would argue, promote these lifestyles right under their own roofs.
Mm-hmm.
The parents, foster parents, could not say anything bad about these behaviors if they occur among foster children. And it would set up a state complaint line so that foster kids could basically tattle on their foster parents if the foster parents did not, quote, accept the homosexual or transsexual activity.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, so with it, if I were a foster parent and I had my own kids and some foster kids in our home, and one of the foster children, in a sense, began coming on sexually to one of my kids, then this law would prohibit me or from saying anything against it or correcting that child?
Well, you could take action to protect your own child, but let me give the scenario where two foster children, both of the same sex, are saying that they're both homosexuals
mm-hmm.
or acting that way.
Mm-hmm.
You as a foster parent would have to accept that.
And approve of it, so to speak,
yeah,
at least
really.
In the silence.
You'd have to promote it, and you would have to undergo, as a foster parent under this bill, training to make you sensitive to this stuff, and you would actually have to go through that training that includes teaching children about teenage sex practices, so,
gosh,
quote, gay sex
mm-hmm.
practices. You would have to become an expert on so that you could accept that as your part of raising the children.
Mm-hmm. So if the problem with finding foster parents is bad now, wait until this goes through, in addition to the obvious moral problems of the bill itself.
Exactly. And really, the genesis of this bill, since you were talking about genesis,
mm-hmm.
What is going on here is that there's been very, very confused kids in foster care. Greg, it's a sad fact that most children in foster care have already been sexually abused
mm-hmm.
in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been sexually confused kids who have gotten involved with homosexuality, and you have had Christian foster parents say, you know what, you weren't born that way, that's not right,
mm-hmm.
you shouldn't be thinking that way, let us help you with going the straight path
mm-hmm.
here. And the homosexual groups don't like that. So what AB 2651 is all about, it's about shutting up Christian foster parents because they want to invade your house, and that's the intolerant face of the homosexual agenda.
Right.
They don't care about the sanctity of even religious freedom or parental rights
mm-hmm.
of foster parents.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening this week? Because this pretty much was the subject of your conversation with Scott last week. What's happening this week that us Southern Californians need to know about?
I want to give out some phone numbers and an address or two because we need to expose this to the media. We need to put some pressure upon Governor Gray Davis and some key Democrat legislators in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Our organization, Campaign for California Families, is holding 7 news conferences, and we're really going to try to work to get some media coverage. But we need you there at the news conferences so that the media and the politicians know that you care. Greg, we're going to be in Montclair Monday at 11:15.
Okay, this will be tomorrow. This is tomorrow,
right?
Right? Monday tomorrow, 11:15
right.
in Montclair.
If you're in the Inland Empire, 11:15 in Montclair at 4959 Palo Verde Street.
What is that? Government building or something?
Well, it's in front of the office of Assemblywoman Gloria Negrete McLeod.
Okay.
So 4959 Palo Verde Street near Monte Vista Avenue.
Okay.
11:15 there. Then at 1:15, we'll be in front of Gray Davis's Riverside office. He has regional offices. At 1:15, we'll be in Riverside at 3737 Main Street in
mm-hmm.
downside Riverside on the mall there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Monday. Tuesday,
okay.
We'd love to invite you to Inglewood. We'll be in front of the office of Assemblyman Jerome Horton of Inglewood. He's a freshman Democrat legislator.
Mm-hmm.
That is in front of Inglewood City Hall, One Manchester Boulevard, just west of La Brea Avenue.
Yeah, the enforcer is going to be there. Melinda will be there for stand of reason. At that, that's 945 Inglewood in front of the Inglewood City Hall. And then you have one in the early afternoon in Santa Ana, right?
Right, at 1245 outside the district office of Santa Ana Assemblyman Lou Correa. Uh-huh. That's at 2332 North Broadway. It's a little hidden, but it's near the intersection of Main and Santa Clara Avenues, just south of the 5 freeway. Mm-hmm. And we're basically calling upon all these folks to oppose AB 2651. We'll be announcing that to the media regarding Gray Davis. See, Gray Davis is undecided, quote-unquote, on this mm-hmm. bill right now. Mm-hmm. And when we are talking about the Inland Empire in Orange County, Gray Davis is not assured of victory in the election
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to do some shining of a light to expose things.
So a show of force here could catch his eye, maybe for the wrong reasons, but, you know, whether in pretense or in truth, if he sees a lot of people in the Inland Empire are against AB 2651, then by people showing up at these press conferences that you'll be having, then that could make a difference in the way he approaches this bill.
Right. And so, one, come to the news conferences. Two, if you can't come to any of the news conferences, make sure that you call Governor Gray Davis and some of these key assembly members. Governor Gray Davis's phone number in the Inland Empire is 909-680-6860,
mm-hmm.
and in Sacramento, 916-445-2841, 445-2841.
Mm-hmm.
More information on the phone numbers to call at our website, www.savecalifornia.com.
Yeah, that's great. So all the information, actually, the press conferences, the phone numbers and everything, and other information about AB 2651 is available there at www.savecalifornia.com. Is that right?
We'll have everything except the news conference locations there.
Okay.
So that's where we've been particular about giving them out here.
Okay. Let me just go through them one more time. If you're in the Montclair area, this will be tomorrow at 11:15 a.m. It'll be at the district office of Assemblywoman Gloria McLeod, and that's at 4959 Palo Verde Street. In Riverside, at 1:15 p.m. tomorrow, Monday, at the Inland Empire office of Governor Gray Davis. This is 3737 Main Street
Riverside.
In Riverside, right, near the intersection of Mission and Market. Then Tuesday, you'll be in Inglewood and Santa Ana. Inglewood in the morning at 9:45 in the morning, outside of the Inglewood City Hall, and that's for Assemblyman Jerome Horton. And then 1245 in Santa Ana, the Orange County, with Assemblyman Lou Correa at 2332 North Broadway. That's his district office.
Right, exactly. So, Greg, anything good in life, I've found it takes time, prayer, and money.
Yes.
It really does. That's how Stand to Reason operates. That's how we operate. That's how good things get done in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're asking you to spend a little bit of your time, come to these news conferences, spend some time on the phone. Call Governor Gray Davis and some key assembly members, encouraging them to oppose AB 2651, the transsexual agenda bill. We're using the worst thing about it to identify it, which is still something that would shock someone like Governor Gray Davis, who doesn't quite think that California should be a transsexual state, though he's accepting almost everything else.
Yeah, that's true. Randy, thanks for giving us a little update on this, and God be with you tomorrow in these press conferences and the next day and your fight here for California families.
Well, thanks so much again. Information on the web at www.savecalifornia.com. All the phone numbers to call to activate yourself and others to oppose AB 2651. Greg, thanks so much.
Yeah, it's good talking to you, Randy. Say hi to Cindy for
me. All right, bless you.
Okay, bye-bye. Randy Thomason here, Executive Director of Save California Families. Once again, that website, www.savecalifornia.com. Savecalifornia.com. And I hope you can make it either in Montclair at 1115 at 4959 Palo Verde Street tomorrow, or in Riverside at 1:15 at 3737 Main Street tomorrow, Tuesday, 9:45 a.m. at Inglewood. You might run into the enforcer there in the Inglewood City Hall, and then Santa Ana at 1245 at 2332 North Broadway, outside the district office of Assemblyman Lou Correa. Okay, let's see. I want to talk to you before we get to the callers. I want to talk to you about a concept very briefly that, I don't know if some people will be troubled by the way I express myself here, but, sometimes we have good hearts in the way we approach something, but the idea that's being expressed sometimes is a little wrongheaded, and so we have to be careful about the idea and the expression of it and where it goes. And this is a factor that relates to being a good ambassador, of course, and usually I talk to you about some kind of ambassador skill that enables you to be knowledgeable and winsome and present wisdom effectively. But here's a twist. Over the years, I've become increasingly concerned with one tactic of some well-intentioned ambassadors for Christ, and that is leading a person in the sinner's prayer. I think it can be meaningful, but I think it has a liability. Now, you know what the sinner's prayer is. You find it at the end of tracts. Maybe you prayed the prayer yourself to become a Christian. I did back in 1973. It goes something like this: Lord Jesus, I'm a sinner. I believe you died for my sins. I receive you as my Lord and Savior. Please come into my life. And that kind of thing, some version of that. And I think the prayer itself is fine. As I mentioned, I prayed a version myself. And I've used it to assist others in expressing their faith for the first time. But on occasion, I noticed something alarming about it. And this is all I want to alert you to. When I ask if a particular person is a Christian, sometimes the response I hear is, well, they prayed the prayer. I mean, it's almost as if the words were the magic that puts the fire insurance in force. If you just recite it, you're in. Now, nobody would say it that way. But in practice, it kind of looks that way. You have a family member. Please pray for my family member, you might say. They're this or they're that. Then you describe some grotesque rebellion or sinful situation that they find themselves in that requires prayer. And you might ask the question, well, are they Christian? Though the description that was just offered would be enough for you probably to know that they're not, or they wouldn't be in this big problem. But you might ask the question, and the response is, well, they prayed the prayer. And, I fear that we've kind of inoculated a whole generation of people who get a partial injection of Christianity and are now resistant to the real thing because they pray the sinner's prayer, they get their fire insurance, and then they disappear, never to be seen again. And when they're confronted with the gospel anew, they say, well, been there, done that. Okay, leave me alone. I have a life to live. And I don't think that the goal of an ambassador should ever be, in this sense, in one sense rather, getting someone to pray a prayer. My emphasis, and I pass this on to you as something to chew on, is always to get someone to follow Jesus. Notice I don't say I'm a believer in Jesus. I usually try to say I'm a follower of Jesus, because a follower of Jesus entails more than just believing or assenting or praying a prayer. And I think it's in the following of Jesus that you really have the heart of what Christianity really is. Because when we emphasize deciding for Christ instead of living for him, I think we often get kind of spiritual miscarriages instead of spiritual births. And our sense of safety, even yours and mine, can't come from simply saying a prayer. So how do we know if any person truly belongs to Christ? Well, biblically, our confidence comes from three different sources. Okay, the first is entirely subjective. I admit this. That might surprise some of you. Subjective? He believes in something that's entirely subjective? Well, yes, I believe in subjective things. It's not like I'm without feelings, right? Or I don't think that your personal, private experiences play a part in Christianity. I do. I just don't think that emotions and experiences are adequate grounding, ultimately, for the truth of Christianity. But there is a place it plays right here. And so how do we know we're a Christian? Well, there's three things that play into this that work together, and one is entirely subjective. The Christian has an ineffable awareness that he belongs to God. And this comes from the witness of the Holy Spirit to our inner man. We read about this in Romans 8. You know, the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and we cry out, Abba, Father, Papa, daddy kind of thing. And John echoes the same thought in 1 John 4:13. He says, by this we know that we abide in him and he in us because he has given us of his spirit. Now, some people put the greatest emphasis on this subjective element, which is something I've concerned about and talked about it, but the scripture actually emphasizes it the least. This is the defense for Mormonism, by the way, this subjective thing. I know because I have that the Book of Mormon is true, etc., because I have the burning in the bosom. Spirit has shown me. And that's it. That's the beginning. That's the end. And that's not adequate, is the point I'm making. That should be obvious to you, by the way, because Mormons don't believe the same thing that you and I believe. We both can't both be right, but we are both proving our points in the same way, a feeling. So it shouldn't be our greatest emphasis. It's unreliable. It shows, by the way, that it's possible to have tremendous inner tranquility even when in extreme danger, all right? And conversely, even the sturdiest spiritual warrior experiences periods of dryness and emptiness and doubt. That's normal. So something more than the subjective element seems to me to be necessary. The second source of confidence is this, biblically speaking now, confidence in our salvation, is the objective promise of Scripture, based on the merits of Christ. And the Apostle John here gives a very characteristic guarantee in 1 John 5:13. These things I have written to you who believe in the Son of God, who believe in the name of the Son of God, in order that you may know that you have eternal life. So our knowledge, our confidence that we have eternal life comes from the fact that we have put our faith in the antidote that God has provided for our spiritual malady. We've taken the medicine. It's guaranteed to do the job. That has nothing to do with the way you feel. You might feel miserable. You might not feel God's presence at all, but this is precisely when the promise looms up as most important, when we don't feel it. And this concept is so foundational, it's repeated many times in the New Testament. That is the promise of God for forgiveness for those who have put their trust in what Jesus has done on their behalf. John 3:16, John 3:36, John 6:40. I mean, Romans 10:9, if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. Okay. Now, there is a third element that is vital to, it's like a three-legged stool to build your confidence that the, in a sense, magic prayer or the sinner's prayer, let's put it non-pejoratively there, is actually in force. Your salvation is working, that from God's perspective, you're his. And I don't think it's wrong for us to ask that question sometimes. More people ought to ask that more often. Or I think we ought to ask that of our friends or relatives more frequently when it seems that there's nothing in their life whatsoever that commends them to Christ, though they make, apart from their occasional attestations that they are Christians. When I return, I'll tell you that third element, then I'll take your calls. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. And these three self-directed studies will cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Will stand a reason. Giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday, 3 to 5 here in Los Angeles. I mentioned the time because if you are listening at oneplace.com or anywhere on the web from our website, for example, you may want to call in. Of course, you're listening, not live, which means you can't call in now, but you can call in. That is now when you're listening, but you can call in now when I'm speaking. That is 3 to 5 on Sundays, 1-800-227-5278, coast to coast, and talk with me and raise your question, comment, reflection with me, and we'll chat together. Just give me a piece of your mind. That's the goal here on Stand to Reason. Incidentally, if you are at oneplace.com, I just want to encourage you to sign up for our free training material. And all you have to do is just scroll down the STR page where you found our show until you see free offer, solid ground. Then click the button that says order right underneath that, and then just follow the prompts. And each month you'll receive training material from SDR at no charge, practical answers to tough questions, thoughtful reflections on current issues, the kind of thing that will help you to be a better ambassador for Christ. And then after you've signed up, you'll be at our website there. Just cruise through our website a bit, and I think you'll enjoy what you find there. STR.org for the rest of you. And in fact, some of the thoughts I'm sharing here at the beginning of this hour are taken from the material that we send out to you. Indeed, this is from a piece that I, a personal letter, what we call it kind of a ministry letter that I sent out just a few weeks ago. If you like what you hear, sign up, and you can receive this for free. My comments here as I start the show have to do with what I have chosen to refer to somewhat pejoratively as the magic prayer, that is the prayer that you pray to receive Christ, which prayer I think is effective, valuable. I've used it, I've helped other people with it, but it has a liability. The liability is that sometimes we think if we could get people to say it, or if a spouse or other family member or a friend has said it, we can breathe a sigh of relief and we figure it's all over, we're covered, they got their fire insurance, they're in, especially if you believe in eternal security. And we don't, though we do care about this, we don't give that much attention to the manner of their life as a way of characterizing, let's see, that's not the right, what I want to say. Their manner of their life as an indication, there is the word, of the legitimacy of that prayer that they prayed. And so I'm raising the question that maybe we ought to be more careful about using that thing, that so-called magic prayer. And rather than just feeling comfortable or confident that someone is a believer simply because they prayed the prayer, the Bible actually gives us three ways of measuring whether one is a Christian or not. The first one is this sense that the Holy Spirit is given by the Holy Spirit that we're children of God, so it's subjective. The second is the promise that we have from God that if we put our trust in Jesus, then our sins will be forgiven. That's from his perspective. I guess there's a sense there's one from our perspective, that is our feelings. From God's perspective, he will honor his promise. And the third, which also is critically important, is a third-person perspective. That is other people watching you. And therefore, this third is the most demonstrative evidence of salvation is a holy life of persevering adherence to the gospel of truth. And John says it bluntly. He says, the one who says, I have come to know him and does not keep his commandments is a liar. 1 John 2:4. Paul warns Timothy, if we endure, we shall reign with him. If we deny him, he will deny us. Peter tells us to be all the more diligent to make certain about his calling and choosing of us, 2 Peter chapter 1. The book of Hebrews is filled with warnings. The teachings of James 2, also hit on the same theme. And Paul's instruction on justification by faith alone is so radical it can be mistaken for license, a charge he defends against, by the way, in Romans 6. And there's so much confusion. I should say there is no such confusion with James, though, because when you look at James chapter 2, he makes it almost creates confusion between law and grace there, because he so strongly emphasizes that genuine faith produces good works, some kind of consequence of significance in our life. So our confidence that we belong to Christ is based on faith in God's promise, evidenced by our perseverance. This is the engine that pulls the train. Our feelings are the caboose. So what makes a person sure his salvation is in force? If all he can say is, I prayed the prayer, or I really feel God is in my life, he may be in trouble. If his confidence isn't based on the gospel of truth, if he's not actively following Jesus, then we can't give him assurance, can we? And sometimes the most loving thing that we can do for a person like that is to give a warning. So often we say, gee, well, I know you really love the Lord. I know you're really a Christian. And we're thinking they prayed the prayer. But we look at the details of their life, and there's not a shred of evidence of Christ in their life. Why are we giving them this assurance when we should be delivering them a sober warning? So just something to keep in mind. There are times when that's appropriate, and maybe the person that you're referring to or you're thinking of that needs the warning is someone as close to you as one of your own children. You are not doing them any favor by giving them false assurances when there's no evidence, continuing evidence, current evidence of Christ in their life. All right? All right, let's go to the callers here, and let's see who's first. Is this Doug?
Yes, it is.
Doug, welcome to the show. Glad you called. Hi.
I love your work.
Thank you very much.
My question is, do you believe in modern miracles? And I'm talking about like the big ones, like demon possession, casting out demons, mm-hmm. raising the dead, regenerating limbs, as opposed to the easy ones like healing cancer.
Mm-hmm.
in quotes, healing cancer.
Okay, all right. Well, I believe,
for instance, your wife hurt her finger, or regenerating a finger. I mean,
right.
What exactly did God do when I know you claimed a couple of weeks ago or whatever that you were praying for God's healing, and what
right.
did you expect, and what happened?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, when I a couple of things to say about the question: do I believe in modern miracles? I think you mean, do I believe that the miracles that happened in ancient times actually happened and can be, in principle at least, repeated in modern times?
No, I believe they happened in ancient times,
okay.
But I have no reason to believe they happened today.
Okay, well, I guess I would say I have no reason to believe that they can't happen today in principle,
right.
Although there
I
might be a question as to whether some
anything,
of those...
But does he?
Yeah, well, I guess the answer to that is yes. I think he does in some cases, But here's where you have qualification. One is a theological question, and the other one is a question in a sense of actual occurrences. Theologically, I would say this to you, Doug. I have no reason to believe that whatever God did in the past, he couldn't or wouldn't do in the present, given the right set of circumstances and a disposition. There isn't something like a threshold that we've crossed theologically in the calendar of developing church history that in which God has decided, sovereignly decided, whatever, to put all of those certain types of working in the past and never do those again in the future. I don't see that. Now, the question might be, well, if there isn't something like a threshold that has been crossed over, why is it we don't see more of those things? And that's a good question. It may be, well, you say the quote-unquote, what we seem to see is God helping technology along, like that's what I think you're referring to, the quote-unquote prayer, healing of cancer, as
right.
opposed to a limb that is withered and then gets then is made whole, or a
right.
blind man seeing.
Now, I'm saying, is God performing a supernatural miracle the best explanation for someone being healed of cancer?
I don't know. And, well, if a person is healed of cancer, then he's healed. That sounds, that's miracle language. But I think what you mean is if they get better,
did God set up natural processes that work?
Sure.
And sometimes they fail, not because of a lack of God, because he allowed a certain amount of chaos or fallenness or death
or
in the
or
world.
Or whatever he allowed, sure.
Unreasonable for a Christian
to assume
that because he prays, you know, God's going to heal this. And there's good people whose boys die.
Right, of course. Yeah,
like
I'm with you on that. And I think, but that is true in the past as well as the present.
Right.
So when these other things were happening where limbs were being, or when withered limbs were being restored, etc., the other was going on too. There is a natural process that God has put into place, and his common grace kind of keeps it maintained. But and then there are you know, things happen. People get sick, and sometimes they get better, and sometimes they don't. Now, can God intervene? Yes. Does he intervene? I believe he does. There was a case where I had a TMJ syndrome, which is a problem with my jaw, and
right.
Someone prayed, and it just went away. Now, I'm going to give credit to God for that, although I didn't feel like a big shaking in my body or heat coming down. There was nothing like
right.
that. It just stopped hurting.
Now,
okay?
What if you're wrong and he didn't do that?
Oh.
What if it was a natural process that just coincidentally, or psychosomatic, because you believe you're being prayed for,
yeah.
It helped?
Right.
Because I have a Buddhist neighbor that told me that, you know, a tumor blew out her side.
Right.
Because of her positive energy or whatever.
Right, right, right.
I couldn't stop the personal, I couldn't attack the personal, you know, testimony.
No, right. I understand that. Well, the what if questions can't be answered. You say, what if? It was just, well, I don't know what. Are you asking the question, could it possibly have been that? I guess that the...
I'm saying it's likely that it wasn't God.
No, well, it depends on the circumstance, I guess.
Right.
In that particular case, you know, I'd been prayed for before, and I'm not the kind of guy who's looking for a miracle under every bush. In fact,
right.
I didn't have much confidence myself in the prayer. Somebody said, well, can I pray for you? I didn't seek it out. So it isn't as if, from what I could tell, any psychosomatic forces were at work there.
But
so I don't attribute.
God, excuse me for interrupting, but if you give credit to God for that prayer, and then I get a check in the mail and I say, God gave me a check, or isn't it great the way, I have a friend who's a, I'm not even going to it, but he has an overt sin, like he has an affair with an
mm-hmm.
unmarried woman, and he goes, it's great that God protected me from the husband finding out. Now, in that case, it totally sense. That's a loaded question, but I'm saying,
yeah.
I hear a lot of Christians say, oh, God gave me a check,
well, look
or
at,
God helped
right.
me get this car,
okay,
or
right,
job,
sure.
And I just go, I don't think that's God.
Okay, well, certainly it's not going to be God, I think, helping a man commit a sin, all right? So, I mean, there are some things, it seems, because of the nature of the answered prayer, there is no other way to attribute it than a supernatural involvement from God. I mean, if I asked God to levitate that car because there was a child pinned underneath it, and it levitated and I dragged the child out, I would say, that's pretty safe to say God did that.
Okay. I'd be right there with you.
Okay, but there are other times where the evidence does not or leaves it questionable as to whether there is a supernatural intervention. But you see, I see God's involvement, and this goes to the thanks issue. I see God's involvement not only in overt ways, but in covert ways and also passive ways, so that every good thing that comes down from heaven is given from God. I mean, God gives good things, and he brings rain, you know, and sunshine on the good and evil alike. So there's a general grace. So if my wife hurts her hand, as you know about,
yeah,
and that
yeah.
heals, I've been praying all along for that healing and for the doctor to have wisdom. And I think that part of the God's grace to us is the good doctors that we've gotten and the rapid healing process, because they say it's pretty amazing how fast it's been healing.
Right.
And so I'm going to give God the thanks for that, whether he mediated that healing directly through a miracle or indirect, which I don't probably isn't the case because it would have been healed immediately, or indirectly through the common grace that he's provided, or even the prayers just helping it along a little bit. I don't know how all of that works, but I'm going to give him thanks, generally speaking.
Well, what would happen if there was some little kid, like in India, with flies all over his face, and he's all skinny or whatever, and he prayed for a job.
Right.
The way that Americans pray for jobs.
Yeah, okay.
He wants to be a successful divorce attorney or a
right.
successful car salesman.
Right.
Why doesn't God answer that prayer?
Well, yeah, I
mean, he can't create an entire dealership in the middle of India.
Right.
So isn't it just strange that Americans pray these prayers, and we're like the fattest, you know, the most luxurious people ever to walk the earth.
I actually don't think
give us anything more.
Yeah, I don't think that matters to God, that last detail. And the reason is it's not a zero-sums game. It's like if I give you this, then this poor kid over here can't get that, you know.
Right.
I think God deals with people as individuals, and he works in lots of different ways. Prayer is one of the most enigmatic things in the Bible, frankly. And I have a hard time figuring it out myself or getting it to work the way I like it,
right.
You know. And so I'm not the best guy to answer on to ask on the convoluted nature of prayer. And even C.S. Lewis mentioned, he said, look, you know, when you're dealing with prayer, you're dealing with a person, not a machine. So
right.
There's nothing mechanistic about it. So, you know, it's pretty hard to say here are the rules that it works by as if it's always got to work mechanistically in that way.
Do you believe that consistency is one of God's characteristics?
You know, I've never thought about that before.
Yeah.
And see, a lot depends what you mean by. I mean, certainly God has certain characteristics in his personality, in his character, that from which he operates. That is, in a certain sense, determine his actions. So everything that God does is going to be good because he is good. Okay,
right.
But that doesn't mean that God is obliged to do any particular act of goodness. In any situation, he still has the freedom to choose whether he would do any particular act of goodness. So,
is he equally generous in different situations?
I don't know. I can't answer that.
If it's based on his generosity,
well, the answer to that
be perfectly generous.
Well, when you say perfectly generous, does that mean he's just this? He's generous to everybody equally in the same circumstance? And the answer is no to that. But that doesn't mean he's not perfectly generous, because you can be perfectly good but not be obliged to use your goodness in every situation. Those are called supererogatory acts, where you're going above and beyond what goodness requires in a circumstance.
Right.
So, you know, I'm going to have to go to break here in just a second, but part of what you're asking here, Doug, turns out to be an unanswerable question, I think. I sense your frustration. I share your frustration with trying to figure this out.
I prayed for your wife.
She's doing well. Thank God.
Being miraculous,
right.
But I can't always explain it, and it doesn't make sense. Right. I have a hard time kind of making that kind of prayer part of my regular life.
Well,
thanks. I'm thankful and all that stuff.
Good. Thanks, Doug, for your call. I appreciate it. And, you know, friends, just as a postscript here before I go to break, you know, when I pray about things, look, if they turn out good, I have reasons apart from God answering prayer to believe that God exists and he's good. And so I'm always going to give him the benefit of the doubt when something good happens like that. I'm going to say, well, I prayed and God did it. And even if I didn't pray and something good came my way, God is the author of all good things. And so I can give him thanks, whether it was done directly or indirectly from God. I think that's the best policy. What's going on behind the screen there? Who knows? We have some faint indications, but this is part of the shroud of mystery, or I should say the cloud of mystery that God is shrouded in, and human eyes do not penetrate that veil. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Hi, friends. This is Scott Klusendorf, and every year in the United States, there are over 1.4 million abortions performed. If you're ready to defend the unborn, then I want to enroll you in a class taught by Greg Kokel and me. Stand to Reason's interactive Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will give you the tools you need to, 1, restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, 2, it will help you simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, 3, it's going to give you the scientific evidence you need to make a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, and finally, you're going to be able to expose the 4 common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. If you're ready to take a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 800-2 and the word reason. That's 800-2 and the word reason, or visit us online at str.org.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel. Friends, you can help keep Stand to Reason broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift of any size helps us to continue training you and other Christians to be effective ambassadors for Christ in three vital areas. First, knowledge, helping you deliver a message that's accurately informed, made relevant to the culture of the 21st century. Second, wisdom, helping you develop a method that's skillful, tactical, and fair. And third, character, helping you cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about in the church and in the world, please consider supporting STR Radio today. We rely solely on the gifts of friends like you to stay on the air. So please call us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. And thank you for sending your gift today.
He touched me, and a joy that floods my soul.
Greg Kokel, back with you here on Stand to Reason, and I guess the music appropriate to the idea of God touching us in miracles, which happens. And look, I know if I opened the phone lines that I'd have many callers that would call in and say, here's what God did in response to prayer. What would be really interesting is to hear from, we're not going to do this, but what would be really interesting is not just to hear these responses from prayer, because as Doug had mentioned or implied, there are a lot of answers to prayer that seems like they could have been that way even if we hadn't prayed, or if we had not prayed but just simply wished, in a sense. Not that there's force in the wishing, but just that it was going to happen anyway, and the wish coincided with its happening. And the point would be, well, then there's no point to prayer either. Well, there does seem to be a category of answered prayer that it's not entirely clear that praying the prayer caused the answer. All right, fair enough. All right, I agree with that. But I said, as a default issue, I'm always going to give thanks, particularly when I pray, if God answers it, even though I could be mistaken and maybe it just happened that way. Paul says, be devoted to prayer. I think this is Colossians. Be devoted to prayer, keeping alert to it with an attitude of thanksgiving. So we pray, and we watch to see if the prayer is answered, so we can say thanks. But it would be neat to hear from prayers, I should say, hear from people about prayers that were answered that were clearly and unequivocally supernatural responses. Or to see here if a withered limb was replaced or a blind man can see. And by the way, I'm not interested at all in God turning silver fillings in their teeth to gold. This is somewhat of a worthless miracle in my view. And if God wants to do it, he's welcome to do it. I don't quite see the point. But sometimes people make a big fuss about those kinds of worthless miracles when they can't seem to get one that makes a difference. Person's dying of cancer, but they're dying with now gold fillings in their teeth rather than silvers. Somehow that something doesn't ring true there. Let's go to Kimberly. Kimberly, thanks for calling. Greg Kokel, hi.
Hi, Greg. I haven't heard your show for a while. I was trying to find you yesterday. Are you on Saturday?
Sundays. From 3 until 5.
Okay.
That's our standard
spot.
Well,
when I heard your show, I thought, I'd call you, this is kind of an old bugaboo from an abortion argument.
Okay.
That goes kind of like this, and I'd like to hear a response because I've never heard it.
Okay. You've never heard a response to this?
Pardon?
You've not heard a response to this?
No, I've never heard a response to this.
Okay, well, I've got one for you. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay.
Because I know it's coming, so.
Okay. I guess you'd say the first proposition was right to life equals right to uterus, because of the fact that there is no other way currently, and this is not a philosophical issue, but the practical
right.
life issue is you cannot have a life without a uterus
mm-hmm.
being growing inside.
Right, right.
And the second proposition being people do not have the right to prolong their lives or extend their lives or whatever, or have a life by, if they need a heart, going and getting someone else's heart or their...
Yeah, let me make this a little tighter here for you because I know where you're going. Does the baby have a right to mom's uterus if mom doesn't say yes? Or is it an invasion of mom's privacy because she's got an unwelcome guest there?
Well, I guess you could say that, but I'm more or less, I want to kind of say, is it not parallel to the... If you could take it strictly out of the gender-related issue, mm-hmm. and say no person
has a right to another
right
person's
to the other
body.
Person's organ to prolong their own life.
Yeah, this is false. First of all, in the illustration is a little bit skewed because to take somebody else's organ to prolong their own life usually means to sacrifice the organ donor's life. Okay. And so it's not entirely parallel.
Well,
the parallel illustration comes from Judith Jarvis Thompson with the violinist illustration. This is a 1972 piece that the philosopher Thompson...
Might be where I read this. But
yes, well, you can actually, to let you know, you can go to our website at str.org, and there is a piece there called Unstringing the Violinist, Unstringing the Violinist, in which I go into great detail about why this argument morally doesn't work. It's an argument by analogy. And she says, basically, you know, what if you woke up and found yourself against your will linked to a world famous violinist, and
right.
your body was
there,
keeping
that's
that
a little bit obtuse to me. I want to stick with my question.
Well, it's the same issue. The question is, can
I don't know about waking up or any of that.
It doesn't. Well, waking is irrelevant. The point is that somebody is a circumstance is forced upon any human being, regardless of gender, in which your body is being used to sustain the life of another body for a period of time, like 9 months, for example. And the question is, does any other human being have the right to do such a thing?
Right, or there are some urban legends about men being plied with liquor and waking up in a hotel room without a kidney because it was taken.
Yeah, okay, well, this isn't – of course, nobody's taking an organ from the mother in this case,
well,
and so it's not quite parallel, but they're using the organ, okay? Now,
well,
so,
it can be. It can happen that way. But
well, that's not – but that isn't the nature of pregnancy. They're not taking the organ away. The baby doesn't take the uterus away from mom and say, I want your uterus. I'm taking it from you. You know, that's she doesn't. The baby lives in mom's uterus. Okay, now here's...
Well, there are some people who lose their uterus as a result.
Well, but that's not... That's an exception to the rule, and the baby isn't stealing it, okay? That's not the point. We want to keep to the basic elements here to look
at... Yeah, but
it's
not like there's this uterus out here in a petri dish. It's actually inside a person.
Of course.
Who's
going. All right, okay. But you're going to have to follow me here, Kimberly, for a second, because there's a line of moral reasoning that's important to answer this question,
right.
Okay? And you are already presuming something here before we answer the question.
Yes, I'd like to know what.
Okay, well, one thing with the illustrations, you're presuming that somebody's losing an organ, and they're not losing an organ, okay, even though there may be extreme circumstances. In the parallels that you gave, they're losing an organ, the kidney guy and all that other stuff.
Well,
there isn't an organ being lost here. It's being used.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so let's keep – in order to make these kind of arguments from parallel, the parallels have to actually be parallel.
The point to focus on is whether or not someone else can use someone else's organ for their own life. Like,
of course.
Put you on a heart-lung machine while I used your heart
of course.
And then give it back to you after I get a heart.
That's precisely the point. That's precisely the point, okay? Now, here's the argument. And here's the way to answer this. There are different ways to characterize this. One is like a trespassing argument. The baby's trespassing in mother's womb without her. She's using this. Okay. Whenever you have a trespass, okay, whenever you have someone trespassing, that person has left his or her proper abode and gone where they do not belong on someone else's property. They go where they don't belong. And if there isn't the factor of permission, then there is a trespass. If there's permission, it's okay.
You're not using a property analogy.
I know. It's exactly the kind of argument that's being used. The woman's body is property, should not be absconded with by someone else for a period of time against her will and be used there. That's exactly the circumstance.
So it's her property. It's her life, you know.
Okay. The answer is, where is the appropriate, proper, legitimate place for an unborn child to be? Where is that place? Where is the appropriate? The unborn child's got to go somewhere. The woman says, if she goes into my uterus, that's trespassing. She is using my body in a way that's not appropriate. It is a It is an inappropriate, immoral use of my body. It's a kind of a trespass. It is a stealing of my womb. That implies that the baby is somewhere where it does not belong and that it is taking something that it does not deserve. So the question then is, what is the proper abode of the child?
I suppose here there might come in another variable, namely, if you relate it to the Roe v. Wade decision where they said there were 3 weeks.
No, this has nothing to do with that. Kimberly, listen, this is not as hard as you're making it, okay? It's a very simple...
Well, it might be because...
It's not. I know this argument. I've gone over it time and time again. I've written on this issue, and I'm trying to explain it clearly. Where does the baby belong? Where is the proper place for the baby to be? The answer is the proper place to for a baby to be is in her or his mother's womb.
But now you're calling it a baby.
But regardless, fetus, we call it whatever you want. You call it whatever you whatever that thing is. Where does it belong?
You know, there's a difference between a zygote and a fetus,
Kimberly,
baby,
Kimberly,
and an adult human being.
That is not relevant to this point. The difference is not relevant to the point.
Then why don't you say where does the adult
Kimberly, where does the zygote belong? Where does the fetus belong? Where does the embryo belong? Choose the term you want. Where does the unborn belong? Where does it belong is the question.
That becomes a strictly
is it trespassing?
Argument that cannot, in my opinion, it doesn't seem like it could have laws applied to
Kimberly, this is, I can't believe that you can't see this. Now listen to me. A child, you're a mom, right? Your child.
No.
I'm just using an illustration. I'm stipulating that you're a mother, okay?
Okay.
For the sake of illustration.
Okay.
You have a 4-year-old. Your 4-year-old opens the door of your refrigerator and takes a glass of milk.
Right.
Is that theft?
No.
Why not?
Well, because, I mean, it's understood that I'm nourishing that person.
In other words, you have a moral obligation to care for the child that is yours. Is that correct? What if you said, I didn't give them permission to go in the refrigerator, I didn't give them permission to eat any food in my house, anything they eat is theft? Would that be morally appropriate?
No.
No, because you have a moral obligation to care for your offspring, even if you don't choose to, even if you don't want to, and even if you don't agree to it.
Well, of course, there's times where people punish their kids for taking things out of the refrigerator.
Well, but that's not the point. The point is, do you have a moral obligation to care for your offspring? Apart from your permission.
That's when the person is already out in the world. You know, I mean, if...
The parallel is the same, though, because she is not only using your uterus, but she's using your body in a different way. You have to carry this baby. You have to nurse this baby. The location of the human being at any stage of development, since you're a little testy about those words there, you're uncomfortable with those words, at any stage of the location is irrelevant to the moral responsibility. That's the question. In the issue that's being raised is, why should the unborn, be allowed to take over my uterus when I didn't give permission? And my response is, well, why should your 3-year-old be allowed to take over your house when you didn't give permission?
Well,
why don't you just...
one thing, I've never given birth, but I've typed plenty of reports where people have given birth, and there's a lot of harm and even death that can come from it, which doesn't happen from taking a glass of water from a refrigerator.
Or
milk.
Okay. So there are risks when there is a more. So you're saying that the only moral difference, the only reason a mother would have a moral obligation, I guess I'm not even clear in your mind what makes a parent have a moral obligation to her child.
I'm kind of confusing. In other words, I'm saying there might be some difference between whether I morally agree that abortion is immoral, and whether or not society has the ability or right to enforce.
Of course, they have the right to enforce things. All laws are.
A woman can be pregnant and go and have an abortion, and no one in the society will know about it.
No, but that's not relevant to the question. The question is whether they have a right to enforce it, not whether they always succeed.
It's not relevant to the morality question, but
right.
It's relevant to the legal enforceability question.
Well, that's not the question we're discussing, though. Listen, let me suggest that you go to our website, Kimberly, and check out Judith Jarvis Thompson's, or actually, check out the piece called Unstringing the Violinist,
okay,
which is my critique of not only Thompson but Kathleen McDonough, who develops a similar kind of argument. Thank you for the call, Kimberly. Let me just go over this very quickly for all of you. The point here is, and here's the moral point, parents have obligations to their offspring, regardless of the level of development of such of said offspring. They have moral obligations towards their offspring that strangers do not have. That is, I am not obligated to your offspring in the way you are obligated to your offspring. And if the arguments like McDonough and Thompson prevail, or the kind that, you know, this woman, Stephanie, is that her name? Kimberly, I'm sorry, Kimberly, that Kimberly is offering, if they prevail, they only prevail because we deny that there are obligations that parents have to their own offspring that they don't have to strangers. Are parents' offspring strangers, morally speaking, to those parents? The answer is no. And the only way that these kinds of arguments can survive is if we treat them like strangers, like attackers, like intruders, like interlopers, people who are there where they don't belong, taking what doesn't belong to them. The only proper place, the only appropriate place, the proper legitimate place for the unborn child is in mom. There's no other place for that child, zygote, embryo, whatever. Seems pretty simple to me. Well, that's all the time we have for our show, friends. Catch us at str.org on the web. Give us a call at 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, if you want to sign up for Solid Ground. And I will be back next week, and we'll be talking about UFOs next week with an expert, and also talking about whether life came from other planets and all of that kind of stuff next week on Stand to Reason. In the meantime, you go out and give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.